You're listening to the New City Church podcast. These episodes are recorded live on Gadigal land. Sometimes the audio quality might not be perfect because what you're listening to is a conversation. We don't edit out the chatter. We think that's what makes it authentic. Wherever you're tuning in from, we hope you find these episodes encouraging.
I'm going to start by saying something really arrogant, if that's okay with you. Sometimes I think my brain is quite arrogant, but I filter it before it comes out my mouth, and so I don't come across as too arrogant, but deep down I really am. You're all nodding as either to say like, yes, we know, or yes, me too. I want to know what one it is, but we'll ask that later. Here's my arrogant statement. We're in the book of Ezekiel, by the way. One of my jobs is as a writer. I write stuff. I started out as a side hustle, and now that's largely what I'm employed to do, just to write as an academic. I just have to pump out the writing. And sometimes you come across something that someone's written, and you're like, oh my goodness, I wish I had written that. Yeah, has anyone experienced that? Maybe it's like with other creatives, you look at it and you think, oh my goodness, I wish I had been the one to come up with that, to put those words together, to create that. Other times, you read something and you think, nah, I could have done better. Yeah, okay. A few of you were like, I could have written that better. Here's my arrogant statement. Ezekiel is in the latter camp. Sit with that as you will. I read Ezekiel and I think, meh, I could have done better. I probably could have written this in a different way. How does that sit with you? Anyone agree with me so far in our reading of Ezekiel yet? Either way, you're going to offend somebody if you put your hand up. Okay, here's my justification. I'm not going to give you the justification just yet. But hold that thought. Let me now tell you about the first time that I ran away from home. Some people lean in. I was 5. I was a super cute child, I like to think. The cutest of the 4 siblings. Obviously, you can all agree on that. I was very angry at mum and dad because after church, they wouldn't let me go to Max Steele's house for a sleepover. Yeah, thank you. Infuriating. Like, who would stop their child from going out for a sleepover on a Sunday night, mind you? We didn't go to the same school. So they put their foot down. They said no. So naturally, I took it upon myself to run away. I packed all of my gear, you know, really maybe a packet of shorts, a pair of shorts, I did the little stick with a tie-up thing on the end. I did it, and I walked up the driveway. I turned right. Lo and behold, my mum had called my neighbours to say, look out the front, Joel's running away from home. Stitches. I'm walking up the street thinking, what a marvellous escape I've done. My next-door neighbour comes up and says, Joel, I think it's a good idea you go home. And I say, yeah, actually, I think that's a good idea. So I turned around and went home. Dramatic, wasn't it? I have always been a wild child. So that was my story. Anyway, the reason why I tell those two anecdotes is because the message of Ezekiel is go home. The message of Ezekiel is it's time to come home to God. Oh, Israel. Israel who are in exile. It's just that I don't like the way Ezekiel really tells the story very much at points. There's points in it where I'm like, ew, that's not how I would have got this message. I like your message. Don't get me wrong. I like your message of it's time to come home to God. But the way you tell the story at this point, I'm not super, super comfortable with. So rather than starting with Ezekiel, I'm going to start with the prodigal son in Luke chapter 15. If you've been around church for a little while, you'll know this story. It's a parable, a story that Jesus tells. And I want to suggest that Ezekiel is a longer version of the prodigal son and draw some parallels there. Where we're up to in Ezekiel so far, now that I've torn it to shreds and said it's a terrible book and don't read it, I do actually love it. deep down. But where we're at in Ezekiel so far is, number one, we saw that when life doesn't go to plan, neither does God. God doesn't fit into our natural boxes. And so for those of you who find yourself in exile, lo and behold, God's there too. God is with you where you are at. Week number two, which was a fortnight ago, we saw this concept of metanoia, transformation. Even the hardest of hearts can be transformed from the inside out. And then week three, where we're here now, come back home to God, because this is where you belong. The story of the prodigal son. It starts with a son taking his inheritance and leaving. And he goes out into the city, and he squanders that wealth, which is a wild word. He squanders the wealth. You can picture it. It's parties, it's women, it's drugs, it's sex, it's rock and roll. He is living a wild child life until he realizes, oh crap, I'm out of money. And he needs to get a job, can't find a job. Ends up, as the spiral of the story goes down, ends up eating out of the pig's food in the pigsty where he's managed to get a job. And at that point, I like it's at that point, not earlier, but at that point, he's like, oh yeah, I should go home. And he makes up his mind to say, I'll go home and I'll say to my father, take me in as one of your slaves. But as he is walking towards home, his father sees him off in the distance, and we get the impression that the father has been sitting, waiting for his son to return home. And he sees him, he runs, he hoists up his big gowns, runs toward him. And the son says, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servant, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. One of my goals in life is to have cause to kill the fattened calf. I think that would just be a wonderful celebration to do. Dirty, but exciting. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and he's found. And so there's a big celebration. There's other complications, but it's this story of this son who goes astray, but then says, it's time to come home. And the father is waiting. The father is excited. The father is overjoyed that this son of his has chosen to come home. And this I think, is the message of Ezekiel over and over again. But as we'll see, it doesn't always translate well into the 21st century. Because Ezekiel, it's a very different type of literature. We spoke about apocalyptic literature a fair bit in our Revelation series. Ezekiel is that. It's violent, it's exaggerated, it's weird, it's metaphoric. And so when we take Ezekiel, we have to filter it through all of these cultural lenses before it comes to us. And so from the outset, week one, I told you that Ezekiel has some of my favorite images in the Bible, but it also has some really complicated ones. Tonight, we're going to sit in one of those complicated images. And so heads up, it situates around domestic violence. God is depicted as a spurned lover who becomes quite violent. And so we'll discuss that a little bit. And I want to take this as a chance to also talk about domestic violence in community, how we as a church community consider that topic. So as always, if you need to grab a cup of tea, step outside, please do that. I trust that you will take care of yourself as we go through. And our method for that is gently, gently, as we peel open this conversation. We're going to look at two symbols within Ezekiel to get our head around this concept of how it looks for God to say, come home to me. But before we do that, shall we do a history lesson? Yeah. Who are our history buffs? We have one, we have two, three, and then maybe we have a few closet history buffs. In order to understand our signs and symbols, firstly, we just need to grasp a little bit of what is going on. It's 597 BCE. Babylon, which sits to the northeast, I'm terrible with directions at the best of time, so I'm going to have to do it in reverse for you. Northeast, over here, of Israel, they have invaded and they have captured not all of Judah, but they've taken away the cream of the crop. They've taken away the doctors, the lawyers, the religious leaders, the teachers. They've taken them away so that they could embed them into Babylonian society and try and assimilate them into Babylonian society before they feed them back into... This is how the Babylonian civilization took over. Right now, Babylon rules from Iraq up into Syria, right through to Turkey. They took over the Assyrian Empire, and they are the major dominant force in the region at the moment. Okay, this is at the moment, 600 BC. Israel is here in the middle, and to the southwest lies Egypt. And Egypt is another big player. They too are powerful. But Israel is trapped in between them. And whenever we talk about Israel in the Hebrew scriptures, remember we're talking about a very different Israel structure to today's Israel. Just keep that in mind. But you can imagine the terror of the Israelite people. They are surrounded by powerhouses. They are weak. They are small. Babylon has come in and taken a bunch of their favorite people away and has now laid siege to their city. If you're a fan of Lord of the Rings, this is Minas Tirith all over again. Nope, no one. Thank you. It's surrounded. Gondor is about to fall. I get excited thinking about that. But Jerusalem is surrounded. What is going to happen? At this point, and this is actually a lot of the plot line for the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, but often we don't really talk about this much. At this point, Israel has to decide, who do we ally with? Now, Yahweh has said, you don't ally with anyone because I am your God. I will protect you. But Judah, complicated, but Judah, where Jerusalem is, has to make a decision. Do we go with Yahweh or do we ally with someone? And they say, let's ally with Egypt. Now, if you know your Israelite history or if you've watched the Prince of Egypt, you'll know that in the DNA of Israel, embedded in the very psyche of the nation of Israel, Egypt is the enemy. And so Israel chooses to ally itself with the enemy. And as they do that, they adopt the gods of the nations around them. Rather than worshiping Yahweh, rather than following the God who they had covenanted with, they have assimilated around themselves, into themselves, through everything. They now essentially just look like a little Egypt or a little Assyria or a little Babylon. They've absorbed the gods in. Ezekiel goes one step further and says, not only are you like the nations around you, you're worse than the nations around you. Remember a fortnight ago, we kept saying, Israel, you're a rebellious nation. That was the language that Ezekiel keeps using. And so chapter 18 talks about this spiral down that Israel went on. And it speaks specifically about the men of Israel and says, your typical man of Israel, he eats at the mountain shrines, he defiles his neighbor's wife, he oppresses the poor and the needy, he commits robbery, he doesn't return what he took in pledge, he looks to the idols, he does detestable things, and worst, he lends interest and takes a profit. I just love that little jab that's in there, as though that is a heinous crime. But there's something about the way that God wanted society to be structured, which didn't profit off the poor and the marginalized. So that's the context, that's the political context of Ezekiel, where we find ourselves. Ezekiel is one of the people who have been whisked out of Judah, out of Jerusalem, and into Babylon. So he is in exile, and he gets this message. Oh, Israel, you need to repent. You need to metanoia, be transformed. And we get a hint of it early on in the book, and it gets more and more clear that one day this will happen. In chapter 18, God addresses the mountains of Israel, the big mountains that go right through the middle of Israel. And God says, but you, O mountains, will produce branches and fruit for my people Israel, for they will soon come home. And that's the plot line of the rest of the Old Testament. It's Israel coming home. Now that's Ezra, Nehemiah. Here's the complication. The explicit goal of Ezekiel, the book of Ezekiel, is to call God's people Israel back home, not necessarily to Jerusalem, although that's part of it. It's calling God's people home to God, to say you've abandoned Yahweh, you've put your trust in idols, you've abandoned the law of Yahweh, L-A-W and L-O-R-E, of Yahweh, the law of Yahweh, and you've given up on justice. You're oppressing the poor, and it's getting worse and worse. Come back to God. Come back to Yah. That's the explicit message of Ezekiel. But there's an implicit question that I think, and when I say I mean much smarter theologians who I read, that I think is going on here. There's an implicit question in the book of Ezekiel, and that is, what the hell went wrong? What the hell went wrong? How did we get here? How did we go from Israel, from God's golden child, a beautiful jewel in God's world, to now in exile, surrounded, sieged, and about to fall? What the hell went wrong? So remember that. There's the explicit message of Ezekiel, come home, and the implicit question, which is, what the hell went wrong? Remember that. I'm going to ask again, and you better remember it. The answer to that question, I'm going to give it away straight away. The answer to that question is both political and it's theological in Ezekiel. Are you with me so far? I know I'm kind of pouring a lot on you in terms of history and the overarching thing, but I think in the middle of Ezekiel, we need to crunch time. It's both political and it's theological. Politically, it's you rolled the wrong dice, you partnered with Egypt, they kind of suck when it comes to the powerhouses, and you chose the wrong side. So Babylon is going to come in and take the rest of you away. So there's a political answer to that question of what the hell went wrong. But there's also a theological answer, and that is much more important for Ezekiel, who is a priest, remember? And his answer is, you did not trust that Yahweh could protect you, and so you turned your allegiance elsewhere. And so Yahweh has allowed this calamity to come upon you. This is the natural outworking of your rebellion. You go against Yahweh, there are ramifications. We might say there are consequences to your sin. That's the theological lens that Ezekiel brings at this point. Any questions with where we're at right now? Making sense? Cool. Let's jump in then to two of the symbols that come up within the book of Ezekiel. Henry Nguyen, who was a theologian, said this. Certain events, current events, historical events, critical incidents, and life circumstances serve as signposts pointing to the will of God and the new creation for those with eyes to see and ears to hear. I love that. As we go through these symbols, as we think through more of the history of Ezekiel, there's an invitation to keep our eyes peeled, our ears to the ground, to hear, to see where is God moving in a new creation way. And C.S. Lewis, author of Narnia, who was also a great theologian and thinker, he said this: symbolism exists precisely for the purpose of conveying to the imagination what the intellect is not yet ready for. Did we get that? Symbolism exists precisely for the purpose of conveying to the imagination what the intellect is not yet ready for. In other words, the prophets use symbols and imagery to convey messages that perhaps Israel, maybe even we, are not yet ready to hear, but those symbols stand and they remind us. And so as we come across them now, even if they're quirky, even if we don't quite understand them, that they're there to remind us of something deeper. So symbol number one, I call this one a close shave. Chapter 5. Now, son of man, this is God speaking to Ezekiel, take a sharp sword. Has anyone ever held a sword before? My dad went to an antique something or other one time and brought home a sword and gave it to me, which as a child I thought was absolutely wonderful. As an adult, I think was probably irresponsible. But it was such fun I set up these cardboard people. They were always people in hindsight. Cardboard people. And I would just go and chop their heads off. And it was such a joy. Anyway, God says to Ezekiel, take a sharp sword and use it as a barber's razor. I can't picture using a sword as a barber's razor. That feels hazardous. Use it as a barber's razor to shave your head and your beard. Then take a set of scales and divide up your hair. So Ezekiel is now bald. This is a form of street theater. Ezekiel is now bald. He's taken his hair. He gets a set of scales and he divides it. When the days of your siege come to an end, burn a third of the hair inside the city. Take a third and strike it with the sword all around the city. Like, it just would have looked weird, you've got to admit, old mate Ezekiel. And scatter a third to the wind. For I, Yahweh, will pursue them with a drawn sword. But take a few hairs and tuck them away in the folds of your garment. So this is, do you get that image? He's just done a piece of street theater, we'd call them sign acts, and there is a message that goes with this sign act. Thankfully in Ezekiel, every time he does one of these symbols, he enacts one of these metaphors, he then goes on to just tell you exactly what it's about anyway, so you kind of think, well, why did you just not do that and just tell us? But anyway, there was an image to go with it. In chapter 5, this is what the sovereign Yahweh says. This, the hair, is Jerusalem, which I have set in the center of the nations with countries all around her. Yet in her wickedness, she has rebelled against my laws and decrees more than any other nations and countries around her. She's rejected my laws and not followed my decrees. Therefore, this is what the sovereign Yahweh says. You have been more unruly than the nations around you and have not followed my decrees or kept my laws. And so, Yahweh says, I will hand you over to the Babylonian might. But it's not just a handing over here. There is also a pursuing that you might have noticed takes place with a sword. God is also active in this moment. And as Ezekiel unfolds, as we saw last fortnight, we discover that that Israel is not yet ready to change. Ezekiel is not yet ready to be transformed. And that's the great tragedy of the book. God is sending them messages to say, come back to me and this calamity will end. Come back to me and you can be safe again. But it becomes very clear very quickly that Israel can't yet comprehend a better future. They can't yet trust that Yahweh is safe and that Yahweh can protect them from Babylon and Egypt. Now, I want to cut Israel some slack here. Perhaps more slack than is due, I don't know. But if I was in Israel, I would have been terrified. I would have been scared. I would have been nervous about the impending doom that was about to come. So I don't know how I would have responded at that point. I like to think that I wouldn't have slidden down that slide of injustice. I don't know. I'm not in Israel's camp. But what this does do at this point in the story of the Old Testament is it sets up a longing, this deep, deep longing for transformation that says we need something new. We need something radical. We need a shift to happen. In Ezekiel's words, we need a new heart. The New Testament picks up this language of transformation. And we'll get to that a little bit next week. But at this point, here is the metaphor. Ezekiel has shaved off his head and beard, and he's divvied it up. He's burnt a third of it. He's chopped up further a third of it, and he's thrown a third of it to the wind. And Israel hears this message and hears, this is going to keep going. You're going to keep suffering unless you trust Yahweh. That's symbol number one. I don't know how I feel about it. It's there. I think there is a beautiful truth somewhere in that, and we'll pull it out a little bit later, but it doesn't really do too much for me. But can we keep going on? Because I want to land it after getting through symbol number two. Symbol number two is the one that I warned you about in week one, and we're here now. It's Ezekiel 16 and 23, and it's the image of an adulterous wife. 16 and 23, they tell two different stories, but with really similar themes and similar structures. We're just going to focus on chapter 16. Both of them picture Yahweh as the husband in the relationship, and then Israel as a woman. And in 23, there's also a sister. These chapters have been banned from being read aloud in synagogues since about 100 AD. And for good reason, they've been really toned down in the English to protect you and your delicate ears. So there's lots of talk of penises the size of donkeys and emissions like horses. There's lots of graphic, it's deliberately pornographic. So if you didn't think the Bible was vulgar, like welcome to church. There's a lot in there that is weird and deliberately confronting. It's also really derogatory to what we would call these days sex work. But the idea that is put across is the adulterous wife becomes a prostitute. Well, I'll tell the story in just a moment. Robin Whittaker, who actually spoke here a little while ago, she's a feminist theologian working in Revelation, which has a lot of overlap with Ezekiel. She makes a really good point. I encourage you to all read the book Revelation for Normal People around how we handle the language of sex work and prostitution in the Bible because of how derogatory and denigrating it is. And it's tied to the woman really closely in unhelpful ways. So I encourage you to go look at that. But for now, I'm going to tell you the story. Yahweh discovers a baby at the beginning of chapter 16, and the baby is covered in blood. And Yahweh takes this baby in and raises this baby as a beautiful young child who becomes a beautiful young woman. Yahweh adorns this woman, Israel, with beautiful clothes, with jewelry, and she becomes a stunning young lady. Israel, in this chapter, refuses to acknowledge Yahweh's beneficence, the generosity of Yahweh, instead gets bored of Yahweh and uses her beauty to entice the nations around her to sleep with her. Assyria, Babylon, and Egypt. We're in this real rich metaphor language. But those nations, in the same way that she grew tired of Yahweh, those nations grow tired of her. It's those nations, by the way, that are depicted as virile men. And so the place of prostitution, the place of sex work in this story inverts, and she ends up giving them money for them to sleep with her. Such is her treachery, is the idea, against Yahweh. It's like, you haven't just rejected me as would eventually become lover. You haven't just rejected me as your lover, but you have spurned me, you've gone out, you've been unfaithful to me, and now you've shamed me, Yahweh, amongst all these nations. There's a lot of patriarchal language there where the man has become shamed. Yahweh is enraged at this behavior, and so gathers together all of her ex-lovers and organize it so that they take turns in stripping her naked and beating her. And then once she's utterly humiliated, she crawls back to Yahweh, repentant, and Yahweh accepts her back. Now, I was raised in conservative evangelicalism, which typically ignored these passages altogether. And for good reason, I say again. It's a really horrific passage to read, to think of God as the perpetrator of such violence. So I don't think I ever heard this passage spoken of at church, which really set me up to fail when I started reading the Bible for myself and discovered, oh, this is here, but I didn't have a framework, a structure to actually understand what the hell is going on here. Because I thought God was good. But when I read about this God, I want nothing to do with this God. When it was spoken about, God's violence, in the churches that I grew up in, it would often take the tone that many theologians have taken. To quote one, Daniel Block, who's a fairly prominent Ezekiel theologian, would say, the fact that God was agitated isn't surprising. This was the natural response of a spurned husband. Yahweh is perfectly justified in bringing Jerusalem's conduct down on her own head. The zeal of his anger is a reflex of the intensity of his love. In other words, Yahweh was right in doing this. But there's also been a long counter-narrative, a counter-history to that theology, which really was amplified by feminism, to look at these passages and say, I'm not sure that this is okay. Sharon Morton Mumby, a feminist theologian, she sums up the story and says, Yahweh uses Jerusalem's lovers to re-reverse and revenge her perversities and also her persistent prostitution. She uses quotation marks there. He even threatens to double the punishments, leaving Jerusalem dead and her body mutilated. Only then, as control is well and truly restored to Yahweh, with no opposition left to face, will Yahweh be calm and no longer angry? A disquieting end to this narrative for all its echoes of domestic abuse. Elday comments, a remarkably quick turnabout if we did not know about the battering model. The battering model isn't a phrase that we would use much these days, but we would certainly speak about cycles of power and control. That's the space that we're in. So we're in this situation where God is depicted as a violent lover. Mary Shields, another feminist theologian, observes, as with the rhetoric of the abuser in spousal abuse, the victim is entirely at fault and has, caused this rage and violence. The violence itself satisfies the abuser's rage and is followed by a calm, which lasts until the next episode. Some context for my work. I've worked as a social worker for many years. I have not worked directly in domestic and family violence, but it's always been adjacent to my work because many of the families that I've worked with have experienced domestic and family abuse. And it is devastating, it's tragic, it's horrific to watch, and being part of their journeys is a deep honour. Getting them plugged into services is extraordinarily violent. But one of the things that you learn very quickly in this line of work is the cyclical nature of it. The way that a perpetrator can become violent and then desperately plea for mercy, forgiveness, give gifts. There's a period of peace. In that period of peace, often the victim will start to think, oh yeah, it was kind of my fault because I said the wrong thing, I did the wrong thing, I didn't appear the right way, I didn't cook what this person wanted, I said an awkward thing at the party. Like, it kind of makes sense that it was my fault. And then it builds up until there is another episode of violence. The best framing that we have for that at the moment is that all of that, that whole cycle is abuse. That whole cycle, the gift giving is a form of abuse. The forgiveness, the seeking for forgiveness is a form of control. Does that make sense? So I wanna give that as the context for what domestic and family violence looks like that we now have in the 21st century. We have that frame, we have that language. Ezekiel obviously didn't. Let me quote another feminist theologian who I've been reading this week, Tamar Kamyankowski. Ultimately, traditional and feminist interpreters agree that Yahweh has the sole power in the relationship. The point of difference resides in the reader's sympathies. Is Israel's powerlessness is Israel's powerlessness a positive sign of submission to God, in which she has chosen that? Or is the powerlessness a reflection and reinforcement of women's subordination? Are God's actions justified as a fit punishment motivated by an ultimately forgiving nature? Or are these actions abusive, derived from jealousy and uncontrollable rage? While both these approaches yield valuable insights, neither method captures the full complexity of the text. And so, this gets to the heart now of how do I read the Bible when there are passages like this? How do I reconstruct the theology that I've been given and frame the Bible in this space? And in particular, how do I read prophetic literature? Take a deep breath. I've really appreciated Pete Enns' work in this space. And so I am going to offer an interpretation of this passage, which may be heresy. We'll see how we go. I'll let you be the judge of that. The task, one of the things we say on our website as our statement of belief is the task of theology is the community's task. It's not one person's task. So I'm going to throw this idea out there, and I would love to have chats afterwards. I'm going to offer a way of reading this passage. I'll introduce you to Pete End's thoughts. But I hope that, for me, as I sat with this passage thinking, oh my goodness, I need to speak on this in a few weeks. I can't just ignore it. I was tossing and turning so many nights thinking, what am I going to say until this twigged for me? And so I'm going to offer it as something that I hope is helpful. But it comes from the implicit question that Ezekiel is trying to answer. Does anyone remember what that implicit question is? What went wrong? What went wrong in this situation? Why are we now in Babylon when we're supposed to be in Israel? And so I think that question helps us understand what's going on a little bit, in a bit of a roundabout way. Let me read for you a quote from Pete Enns, a theologian in the States. When we open the Bible, or when you scroll up in your app and you read it, we are eavesdropping on an ancient spiritual journey. That journey was recorded over a 1,000-year span of time by different writers with different personalities at different times, under different circumstances, and for different reasons. In the Bible, we read of encounters with God by ancient peoples in their times, their places, asking their questions, and expressed in language and ideas familiar to them. Those encounters with God, I believe, are genuine, authentic, and real, but they are also ancient. And that explains why the Bible behaves as it does. So here's my proposition. Ezekiel is trying to make a theological point, which I trust was inspired by God. I trust Yahweh inspired this message to say, come back to me. Stop acting unjustly. Come home to me. This is where you belong. That's the theological point, the undercurrent of both of these symbols. Come home to God. But having been captured out of Jerusalem, having been torn away from his family, having been made a refugee in a foreign land, in a strange place, in a confusing time when he was supposed to be in Jerusalem at the temple, having found himself as a displaced person, Ezekiel is interpreting God through what I would argue is a trauma lens. Ezekiel is a deeply traumatized individual. There's no way to think he is not. So what we're reading is a trauma theology. We're reading what happens to a person when they encounter God, when trauma is at the heart of their experience, day in and day out. And we see this exactly. And what we see in Ezekiel 16 and 23, this pattern, I think, and I would argue, is the exact same pattern that we see in traumatized, displaced people still today. We see it around the world constantly. I see this in my research. I see this in the people that I work with. When they've been displaced, when they've been removed from their homelands, when they've gone through trauma, suffered immensely, there's a pattern of introspection, which starts to say, I'm the problem. I did this to myself. It's my fault. If only I had dot, dot, dot. If only I'd acted differently in this moment, then dot, dot, dot. And so while it's quite true that actions have consequences, I don't doubt that. I don't doubt that in the Bible, in Ezekiel's experiences, there are consequences for injustice. There are consequences for when you walk away from God's good idea of flourishing. There's also a lot of stretching of the narrative, perhaps further than it needs to go for Ezekiel. So if this is how we choose to read Ezekiel, I know that there are implications for this, theologically, and how we approach the Bible. I know that there are questions around then how do we determine what is truly God's voice in the Bible, and how do we determine what's a trauma response in the Bible. But ultimately, this is our theology of how Scripture was written. And I actually think I'm well and truly planted in the realms of historical orthodoxy when I say the Bible was written as a complex interaction between the divine and humanity. That God inspired beautiful messages of come home where you can flourish. And the people looked around them who were tasked with writing down these spiritual journeys of the nation of Israel, and they interpreted it and said, what the hell went wrong? We did. It was our fault. And so God is angry at me. God is wanting to destroy me. Sharon Morton Mumby, who I quoted a moment ago, I'm going to leave a theological point to her at this point, which I just think is profound. These women in chapter 16 and 23, they lie on their side on the ground. Jerusalem, Ohala, and Ohalebah, who are in 23, they are mute, they are dumb, they are silent. And there, these three women become prophets. The hurricane, the earthquake, and the fire of Ezekiel's invective continues. But they speak the still violence, the still voice of sheer silence. And in this book of the dumb sign-acting prophet, they sign-act the lives of abused women and children, defiantly speaking their silence right into the sacred texts of tradition. Ezekiel, the watchman, continues unabated, shouting out his sure and certain theology, and the voice of God lies silent and wounded outside the city walls, which are broken with blood spilling out from the midst of them. Ezekiel does not notice that the Spirit of Yahweh has passed to them from him. He is too caught up in the confidence of his anger. He has forgotten that the prophet is the one who silently sign acts. And these silent female prophets bring all who have been abused dignity and place in the tradition. There's something powerful that in the center of this book of transformation, there are three abused women. I don't believe that God is the perpetrator of domestic violence, metaphorically or literally. I don't believe that anybody can use this text to justify their actions of domestic violence. I don't believe God condones, supports, or justifies it in any way or shape or form. I want to condemn, in the harshest possible terms, any attempt to use the Bible as a means of validating justice, of validating violence. That is where I sit in my theology. Because I see where Ezekiel has been. I see the story that Ezekiel has lived. I see that in so many people that I work alongside. And when we place Ezekiel in the context of the larger biblical narrative, we see a God who is a God of flourishing In fact, just in a couple of chapters' time, we're going to see it. We see a God who is a God of flourishing, a God who is a God of shalom, of peace, who takes the side of the oppressed, who stands alongside the abused. If I was to take my theologian's hat off for a moment and put on my social worker's hat, or maybe in this space, my pastor's hat, I just want to make a couple of, I think, pertinent points that we need to name, and that is domestic and family violence is usually gendered because most of the world is heterosexual, but we know that in queer spaces, that isn't necessarily the case. There are other dynamics at play. We also know, sort of, we don't really know, but there's a few studies that seem to suggest that domestic and family violence in the queer community is about equal to the non-queer community. And so I just want to say, as a church, we've named it, it's there. If that is part of your or your family or your friends' journeys, I am such a fan of bringing it out into the open in healthy and supportive ways. So if you feel like you need to have more of a conversation around that, I trust that you will find safe people. I am happy to make myself available for that. Can we land this? It's heavy. I hope it's not too heavy for you at this point, but I wanted to sit in this passage because we need to have ways of framing these passages that are in the Bible so that we don't turn around and enact violence that is so fundamental. Some of you are currently in exile. I know this because you speak to me about it. Many of you are trying to work out, what do I do with the God who I have been handed? Some of you have sought to understand God through what I would argue is a trauma lens. That is, a God who is retributive, a God who is violent, a God who is angry at you or perpetually disappointed. And I want to honor that lens because that is one experience of the divine. It's also one lens that we see within the Bible as Israel grapples with its relationship to Yahweh. But it's not the only lens. It's not the only lens that the Bible brings. It's not the only lens that you have to bring. And so I'm choosing, in the ancient tradition of working out how to read the Bible, to take the message of Ezekiel, come home. I'm choosing to not take that through a lens of violence, but through an invitation to flourishing. And we take that trajectory through scripture, through Jesus, who shows us a God who disrupts violence and ultimately moves heaven and hell so that you and I can be at peace. That is the story of the Bible. And it's this God who, in John 15, when the prodigal son comes walking back from the pigsty, it's this God who takes up his gown and runs to meet you, opens the doors, puts a ring on your finger and says, let's get this party started because my child who was once lost is now found. I love that picture of God. I love that picture of God. So as we read the Bible, that's the lens that I bring. That's an invitation for you to bring that lens as well. Let me pray. God, there is some complex, messed up stuff in the Bible that you gave us, and yet this is the Bible that you gave us. And so, God, we don't want to shy away from that, but we want to read it wisely. God, we thank you that Ezekiel's story mirrors so many of our stories. When we look at God and we feel as though you are angry and disappointed and frustrated, that you are punishing. And God, it's true that sin has consequences and that you despise injustice. But that's not the only story that Ezekiel tells when we get caught up in these damaging passages, when we focus in on them, or even when we discover them anew after having them hidden away for so long, it can really throw us. So God, in Ezekiel we see that, but we also see a truer, deeper lens of flourishing. We see a trajectory of hope. And as we read on through the Bible, we discover a Jesus who steps down into the muck, into the darkness of our world, and takes all of it upon himself so that we don't have to. God, for those who are caught in those cycles of violence, be that religious violence, be that violence that is justified by religion, God, for all those caught in those cycles, we pray for healing and renewal. We pray for disruption to that violence. God, would you use our community to bring about peace and shalom? God, we thank you that the rest of Ezekiel is much easier. Amen.